This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
My name is Amanda. I am 23 years old. I have autism. When I was a baby, my mom noticed that I would shut my eyes when she nursed. She thought it was painful for me to look her in the eyes. Later, a therapist discovered that I could make eye contact by using a mirror. With lots of practice, I got used to looking people in the eyes. I was a few months older than most children when I learned to walk. But when I learned to walk, I walked on the tips of my toes all the time. And sometimes I flapped my hands. I began to speak around 18 months, but by around age 2, my speech got worse. Slowly, I started to lose words. I was only using one or two words at a time. I couldn't tell people how I felt or what I wanted. I would have meltdowns because I couldn't use my words. I would panic when I was in crowds, or if I heard loud noises, I would hold my ears and scream. If I walked past someone starting their car, I would act as if a bomb went off next to me. The doctors figured out I had autism when I was 4. Then we had tutors come to our house 6 days a week to teach me how to talk. Within 6 months, I was talking pretty much like anyone else. After I learned to talk, I had to learn how to play with others and how to play with toys. I used to line up toys in a row instead of playing with them. Once I could do more things, I started to have playdates with other kids almost every day. At my playdates, I had a tutor who helped me interact appropriately. The tutors went with me to preschool and kindergarten as well. My parents kept me busy with ballet, swimming, and acting classes with the kids that I often had playdates with. One of my biggest challenges was to stop fixating on Disney characters. When someone would change the subject, I would interrupt them and start talking about Disney again. This would get really old to others, and sometimes they would avoid talking to me. My sense of taste was strong. I wanted to eat mostly bland foods. I did like carrots. My parents used that to introduce me to salads and other healthy foods. Also, I had sensory problems. Being touched by people or some objects would overstimulate me. I would run away to be alone and try to calm myself. Currently, a massage therapist is helping me with deep pressure therapy. A positive part of my autism is my great memory. I easily memorize lines from movies and remember people's names. I think in pictures like Temple Grandin, who has autism. I have trouble concentrating with schoolwork. I also have learning disabilities, especially in math and abstract thinking. I have a lot of trouble with my super sensitive ears. That is why I wear these custom earplugs. Sometimes people notice them and think they are hearing aids. Loud noises still hurt my ears. For average noise levels, I wear these earplugs. When I'm at a noisier place, I use a pair of earplugs that block more sound. When I go to movies, opera, plays, and some concerts, I have to wear noise-canceling headphones. At 16 years old, I was beginning to learn how important it was to help other people. I went down to Mississippi to help victims of Hurricane Katrina. This was a few months after the hurricane, and the area was still in a state of shock. If I felt good doing things for other people, it was more about what I could do rather than what I could not do. After high school, I attended classes at Sierra College. I also do volunteer work. I've especially enjoyed working with animals. One of the things I like to do is read. I like reading historical fiction and Greek mythology. For the past few years, I have had an interest in writing. I can see a story in my head like I'm watching a movie. I've completed two short stories. I just finished a screenplay about Persephone, a Greek goddess. I wrote a screenplay this time because I like stage direction and movies. I hope to someday publish my stories and maybe direct or be in the movies. I also love roller coasters, dancing, going to operas and plays, and anything to do with Monty Python. A Touch of Understanding is a program that teaches school-aged children about disability awareness. I started speaking with them in November 2011. A Touch of Understanding sponsors a group of children and young adults called the Youth Force. They come up with fun activities that have community service projects tied in with the fun stuff. The Youth Force plays a big role in my life. When I was a kid, I missed out on having fun. Now, I look forward to being a part of their events. I appeared in the documentary Autism Emerging from the Maze that ran on Channel 6 last year. That was last June. Then I was asked to appear in the KCRA 3 special, Bully, and that aired last October and November. Autism is a part of me, but it does not define me. I still face challenges every day, but I have learned to find the positive in life, and I laugh more. Thank you.
I'm going to be talking today about several different things that are going on here at the Mind Institute with the Center for Excellence in Developmental Disabilities, which, for those of you who may not know yet about this ed, I kind of look at us as the community outreach and education component of the Mind Institute. One of the major things that we focus on and do is community inclusion and helping to disseminate information, research, and applied work, really, to families, practitioners, and educators out in the community. So I chose to focus today sharing with you several of the projects and studies that we're doing around applied work and applied research. This has a lot more to do with solving practical issues and problems, as well as really figuring out how to take an evidence-based practice or something that basic research has already been done with and disseminate it and get it implemented out in the community. One of the projects that I recently joined that I'm really excited to bring to Northern California and to the Mind Institute is the California Community of Practice. The vision is for this group is around transition and to increase education, employment, and independent living success for youth with disabilities, and really to ensure seamless transition and service delivery as individuals transition out of public education and into the adult world and the community. What's exciting about this group is, again, it's applying research. We're working on taking evidence-based practices that we know work in the area of transition and disseminating them and figuring out how through community activities to get these things embedded into our school systems as well as our transition services and supports. And these are the evidence-based practices that are a focus of the California Community of Practice. Another activity that we are working on here at the Mind Institute is Northern California Think College. And this is a group of key stakeholders that meets on a regular basis. We have representatives from a variety of different groups and organizations, community colleges, the school districts, families. And in fact, tomorrow, this group will be having an activity here at the Mind Institute called Embracing Transition, with the goal of bringing high school educators, counselors, and special educators together with community college folks to really look at some innovations and some ways of supporting one another in helping youth transition into college. We also have an activity that we do a couple of times a year called Success Defined. And the goal of this activity is youth development and helping youth who are of transition age to define their goals and help them on a path to making that transition again out of high school into the adult world. We've partnered this last year with the Rao Family Empowerment Center to also provide a parent training component to help families learn information, tools, and resources around transition. And for the first time in June, we will be hosting a Success Defined workshop in Spanish. One of the projects that I've been involved with since coming to the Mind Institute was the National Professional Development Center for Autism Spectrum Disorders. And I wanted to share a little bit about this project with you, even though it has concluded, because we're working to now take what we learned through this applied research and disseminate it and really apply it throughout our state. The MPDC project was a 5-year project funded by the Office of Special Education Programs, and the design was to promote effective use of evidence-based practices within our school systems. We were one of 10 states that participated in this project. We were a dissemination site. And received training tools and resources from the National Professional Development Center for Autism Spectrum Disorders on evidence-based practices. And this graphic right here shows you the evidence-based practices that all of the research has demonstrated to be effective for individuals with autism. For this group, the MH is middle school and high school. So anything in yellow are those that have been shown to be effective practices for working with that age group of student. And you can see, sadly, that on the far right, the evidence-based practices around transition for individuals with autism is fairly sparse. Amy Bard will be sharing with you some exciting new work that's being done to try to fill in some of the holes in that side of this model. The MPDC project basically assisted us in our state, in the state of California, with not only identifying what the evidence-based practices are, but bringing together all of the agencies that are really involved and key in supporting youth through transition. State leadership involvement and an infrastructure were developed for us to be able to learn what these practices were, learn how to use the tools and resources for dissemination, and then practice for 2 years with some guidance implementing these practices within our public school system. These were the activities that the project entailed, including the ability to implement these at 6 different school sites around our state. And I wanted to just capture real quickly the work that we did at one of our demonstration sites, Glendora High School. Of the 6 programs that we had, 1 was a high school, 2 were middle schools, and the rest were elementary and preschools. We wanted to see how this worked across the grade levels and across the ability levels. We targeted video modeling, self-management, and peer-mediated instruction at the high school demonstration site as the evidence-based practices. All of the staff at that site received training and coaching on how to implement these practices. And we identified 3 students that we would implement and monitor the effectiveness of these practices with. The timeline looks something like this. evidence-based practices were selected. They were tied to the IEP goals. The staff was trained. We began implementing them, collecting data, and then December to June, continued implementation and monitored student outcomes. These were the results, and just to kind of give you a brief summary, the zero on these scales represents where we anticipated these students would be on their IEP goals after an entire year of implementation. We went ahead and set goals that were higher than the annual goal to kind of push ourselves to see if we could take it even further than what the IEP team thought was a reasonable expectation within a year. And you can see that two out of the three students surpassed their IEP goals by a long shot in several of their goal areas. So with the success of the MPDC project, we moved on to dissemination, and that's where we're at now. And so our goal is to take the implementation of these practices beyond just six school sites in our state. Obviously, we have a huge state with a great deal of diversity. So we formed a network called the California Autism Professional Training and Information Network, or CAPTN. And the idea with this is that each SELPA, Special Education Local Plan Area, Regional Center, and Family Resource Center will identify staff and have identified staff. We actually have over 325 people throughout our state now identified to come and learn these tools and resources and then be a trainer of trainers at their local at the local level. We're launching our CAPTN network in October of this year, and I think that we'll be able to reach probably all of the school districts throughout California in a relatively short period of time, providing them with training and support in the areas of evidence-based practice. And I'm looking forward to coming and sharing back with you the results of that dissemination effort.
My name's Amy. I'm a speech pathologist, as Robin introduced, and I was able to work on the NPDC project for the later part of that project, and then I have now transitioned over into working on the CESA project. It's, we learned a lot through the MPDC process. We learned a lot about evidence-based practices, about how to implement evidence-based practices, and how to do so in a sustainable way. So in other words, we really strived with NPDC, and we're really striving with CESA, to promote a lot of collaboration within all the school sites that we're working with. So getting administrators involved, RSP teachers, general educators, special educators, other providers like school psychologists, and to really get a lot of everyone involved, because we've found that the stronger the core in a school, the more likely these evidence-based interventions are going to be implemented, and the program will then grow if you have that kind of collaboration. So, CESA is a multi-university study that's looking at evidence-based practices just for high school students. We learned a lot from NPDC about evidence-based practices for a wide range of students, anything from early intervention all the way through high school. But as, that great slide that Patty showed us tells us is that the evidence-based practice for high school students is just not well understood, and we need to do more for that population. So CESA has gathered really the experts in the field to come together and create a comprehensive program for students with high school students with autism. Why is this important? Because when high school students leave their public school systems, the outcomes are not very pretty oftentimes. These statistics are a couple of years old. 80% of still live at home. Almost half have no jobs or post-secondary training. 40% never have contact with friends. 17% never feel hopeful about the future. 21% never engage in outside activities. And many experience, of course, that decrease in services after they graduate out of the public school system. The goal, the purpose of CESA and what we're doing is to improve those outcomes. Over the course of this project, we want to develop an individualized, comprehensive approach for high school students with autism and their families. So not just looking at social skills, not just looking at transition, but looking at a real comprehensive model, package, that schools can take and will help improve the outcomes for students on a variety of levels. We want to examine the feasibility and efficacy for students, staff, and families. We want to share the model and examine the long-term effects of this model. Like I said, this project involves six collaborating universities across the country, including us here at the Mind Institute. We're focusing on five areas. First of all, the first area that we're focused on is the evidence-based practices that we found through the NPDC model, which we've now renamed the CESA Foundations. And these lays the foundation for all the other elements, all the other components of this project. The next element that we're going to be looking at is social competence. So we're actually, I'm going to be talking a little bit more about that. That's what we're piloting right now. The next area that we're looking at is social and adaptive behavior skills. And so this component we've named PRISM stands for personal responsibility, independence, and self-management. The next area that we're going to be looking at is academics, and in particular, reading interventions. We have a couple of reading interventions that we're going to be looking at. And then, of course, transition in families, which is a huge area of need. So let's talk a little bit about what this transition in families component is going to look like. We're going to be developing a program that hopefully will include a lot of parent support and education, community and school mapping, transition planning, and student involvement in the IEP, even as young as that first freshman year, having the students really more involved in their IEP so they can see the broad scope and start planning and thinking about transition. That's a really important piece of it. And of course, career development skills. The next area that we're piloting right now is social competence. And we are actually, there's three elements to this social competence component that is very exciting to be working with. And it's really able to work on social skills across the spectrum of autism. So we have, you know, from kids, the social component will really help kids who are completely not able to say anything, using communication devices to communicate, to kids who are very verbal. We have one aspect of this component is the social skills instruction, which is using a lot of cognitive behavioral approaches to treatment, a lot of talk therapy and thinking about social skills and interactions. This peer support and peer networks are both peer-mediated interventions, which is an evidence-based practice. And what they look at is, you know, students don't like to always learn from adults, especially at the high school level, right? We learn from our peers. We learn from our friends. And so peer-mediated intervention and these peer support and peer networks utilize that. And they're very fun to implement, too. We're having a really good time piloting this aspect of the project so far. This is our academic component that's currently in development, the collaborative strategic reading and alternate achievement literacy, which are two evidence-based interventions that we're piloting. The PRISM includes functional assessment, functional behavioral assessments, setting goals to improve behavior and adaptive behavior skills in high school, developing timelines, and of course, getting really good data collection methods in the schools that are realistic for teachers to utilize and complete. And then, of course, the state-of-the-art practices, those CESA foundations that we're working on, which is looking at how we develop goals for students, making those goals realistic, how we assess program quality at the school level. So all of those things are ways that we're going to be looking at or developing over the course of the next couple of years. This study has four phases. It's a five-year project. We are in year one, so it's very new. It's very fresh. We're just doing our first pilot studies right now, and it's very exciting. It's really fun. But over the course of the next 5 years, we're hopefully going to have a nice relevant and efficacious evidence-based practice model to go and for schools to use and help their programs. We really are going to try to learn and implement interventions and data systems, assessing program quality. Ultimately, we're going to have multiple high schools in the area with as much as 12 students per high school that we're going to be working with. And these are the members of our team. Erin Staubel is a BCBA. I, of course, have a speech therapy background. And Sally Rodge is our principal investigator. And that's CISA. For any more information, this is my email address.
So first, I just wanted to point out that little attention and research has been devoted to lifespan issues, or what we term adult issues. And as you can see here in this pie chart, I've highlighted in yellow, the percentage of funding, both federal and private, that's been devoted to these lifespan issues, such as transition to college. And only 2% of the funding is actually devoted to this area of research. And hopefully over the years, that will expand more and more. So first, I just wanted to talk to you about the National Longitudinal Transition Study. This is by far the largest study on transition and post-secondary outcomes in students with autism, as well as other disabilities. The study consists of 11,000 participants, and 1,100 of them had autism. So there are 12 total different disability categories in the study. It really consisted of a nationally representative sample, so participants were recruited from all over the U.S. And at the start of the study, they were receiving special education services under the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, or IDEA. It was a 10-year-long study, and data was collected every 2 years in the study. The participants at the beginning of the study were 13 to 16 years of age, and after 10 years, they had become 20 to 25 years of age. And for those two-year increments, parents and their youth would complete phone interviews as well as mailed surveys for this study. So now I'm going to just present some of the findings of this large-scale study. So these yellow bars right here, they represent the percentage of students with ASD receiving various services. And you can see here that the two left bars indicate that 50% of these students were receiving mental health services as well as medical services, and up to 80% were receiving speech therapy. And this is all in high school. And then also these students were receiving close to 70% of case management. So this is specifically just the ASD group in the study. So now, once they graduated from high school, all of these services dropped off, as you can see here. So yeah, many fewer services, especially with speech therapy. Case management went down. And of course, this is a major transition phase in their life. They're transitioning out of high school and what they really know well into possibly college or a job or something else. This is when they might need their services the most, or at least they hopefully would be maintained over this phase. Okay, so then in this diagram here, based on the study, they found that young adults with ASD were less likely to enroll in 2 or 4 year colleges than almost all the other disability categories. And in total, there were 12 different disability categories they were examining. And so almost all of them, except two, did the students with autism perform lower in. So in this example here, the yellow bars represent community college, and the blue bars represent four-year college. And you can see the percentage of students with autism who attended either a community college or a four-year college were lower than, for instance, the learning disabilities or speech language. There were only two groups that they actually were higher than, and that was intellectual disabilities and multiple disabilities. And we don't understand why so few are going off to college. So now in this diagram, this bar is representing the students with autism who attended college and believed themselves to have a disability and then informed their university of this disability. So they're actually disclosing the disability to their university. Now only 30% of those students actually received accommodations and supports from the university, so nearly half. And this is a problem, and we don't understand why. So we have some thoughts about it. Perhaps the students don't know how to access the services on campus, or they're not aware of them. Perhaps they have low motivation, they're not seeking out these services, or they might not be good at advocating for themselves. They also might believe that the supports that are currently on campus aren't appropriate for their needs. So we have many questions and we have very few answers at this point. And for this reason, we're currently conducting a study. It's a collaborative project between the Mind Institute and the UC Davis School of Education. So the rationale for our study is that students with ASD are likely to experience significant and unique challenges in adjusting to post-secondary educational settings. And the purpose of the study is to really examine the college transition needs of students with autism. So currently the study is in the data collection phase. We just started 3 weeks ago. So I can't report on the results yet, but I can tell you about the study itself and the design. So firstly, we're recruiting participants who are UC Davis undergraduate students. We're examining four different groups. One of those groups is the autism group. And then we're also recruiting three other groups, a group of students who have ADHD, another group with an anxiety disorder, and then our last group is the typical comparison group. And our goal is to recruit 30 participants in each group. We are examining several factors. Among those are the extent to which college students with ASD utilize campus resources, such as the Student Disability Center on the UC Davis campus. Whether they're receiving academic accommodations and services, and if so, what types they're choosing. And then also we're very interested in examining the level of self-determination. So you may ask, what is self-determination? So this is a set of skills, and it involves evaluating one's own interests and abilities, setting expectations to meet your personal needs, knowing how to make plans and decisions, and this really is a multi-step process. So first you have to really self-initiate the actions to carry out those plans, and you have to evaluate the results of those actions, and then you might need to modify your plans accordingly to meet your results. Self-determination also involves drawing upon the services and supports in your environment. So from our current study, we're hoping to understand self-determination better in students with autism and how that might relate to various academic outcomes. And we're hoping that the knowledge we gain from this study will help us to develop interventions to promote self-determination in students with autism. And our lab has actually already submitted an IES grant, which is the Institute for Education Sciences. And it's really hopefully to receive funding to support this comprehensive intervention program we're hoping to conduct in the next year or two. So please stay tuned for the results from our study. We're hoping to present on it in the next year or two. Thank you very much for your time. And here are some links. You'll have them up only for a minute, but feel free if you're interested. The first one is for our lab. Sorry. The next one is about the study I discussed at the beginning of the talk. And then the last is an organization that some might find helpful. It's for parents, students, and professionals who are transitioning into college.
So why am I talking about reading in a presentation on transitions to adulthood? To begin, I like to think about reading as a form of communication. It's not an isolated skill. Rather, it's a written conversation between an author and a reader. And it has a powerful impact on your everyday life. It allows access to K-12 and college-level curriculum. It facilitates learning about oneself and others. It provides independence through things like access to jobs and understanding information on the internet, for example. And it really enhances lifelong learning in the pursuit of personal goals. The Institute of Education Sciences reported in 2012 that 6.5 million children in K-12 public education in the U.S. received special education services. That was in the year 2009-10. Currently, approximately 500,000 children receiving special ed services have an autism diagnosis. Laura Shifter at Harvard analyzed data from the same study that Tasha was speaking about, the National Longitudinal Transition Study. In this graph, the blue bars represent the median time to graduation in years, and the red bars represent the percentage of students who have still not graduated after 8 years. As you can see, in her study, with 800 students with autism, the median time to graduation was 6.5 years, and after 8 years, almost 44% had not graduated. So these outcomes, like Tasha, I just chose a couple other categories to compare, but the outcomes were worse than learning disabilities, speech and language impairments, or intellectual disability. So why is this? This prompts several questions. Well, probably more than several. Is it related to the different characteristics of particular disabilities and or the services that are currently provided or were at the time of the data collection? We don't have clear answers, as you've been hearing, but we're working on it. But we also want to know, well, specifically, how are they progressing academically in things like reading, math, and other core content areas of the curriculum, especially since so many of these children are now being served in the mainstream classroom. So several studies, and there aren't a lot, but several, have shown evidence of academic struggles that are not commensurate with assessed cognitive abilities. Three of the top ones are on the screen here, and they indicate that 60 to 70% of students in these studies show lower academic achievement in math, reading, and or writing than IQ would predict. These studies also indicate that reading disabilities that are seen in at least a third of their participants were in part related to social and communication difficulties. So of the academic challenges, reading comprehension is a particular, although not universal, challenge that affects between 33 and 37% of the students, at least in those previous studies. In many, but not all, students with reading comprehension difficulties, they actually have word reading and decoding abilities that are in the average range. So that facet of reading often develops in a predictable format, but the deep level of comprehension doesn't seem to correlate with that. Reading comprehension has been shown to relate to oral language abilities more generally and may be part of the school-age expression of social communication disturbance in autism. Successful reading comprehension relies upon many higher-level language-based processes such as inference ability, self-monitoring for meaning, in other words, are you actually understanding what you're reading, and if not, can you go back and reread? Can you ask pertinent questions about the text, especially things like why and how? And can you integrate different aspects of background knowledge and text material to make an integrated whole? These are often abilities that children with autism have difficulty with. So one question that we're asking in our lab is, what is the relationship between reading, oral language comprehension, and social communication behaviors in students with autism? And also, could a targeted intervention through reading comprehension help teachers address both academic outcomes and autism symptom outcomes as well? Before we can answer this question, however, research is needed on the factors that are affecting reading comprehension development in these students. So in a recent analysis from a study that we just concluded about 9 months ago, we looked at the relationship between oral language, and in that study we looked at expressive vocabulary and oral discourse comprehension, and we also looked at oral communication behaviors and how all those related to reading comprehension. This was in 26 students with high-functioning autism, ages 8 to 16, versus 34 age and IQ match typically developing controls. In this particular study, autism diagnosis was confirmed through parent report. And the assessments that we used were a standardized assessment by Wechsler for reading comprehension and oral discourse, and the expressive vocabulary was also from Wechsler. To try to quantify social communication deficits, we analyzed a subscale of a parent report called the social responsiveness scale. And here's a graph that shows you how the two groups performed. This is a group mean. So the blue bars show the group mean standardized score for the autism group, and the red bars show the standardized group means for the control group. What you can see here is that full-scale IQ and vocabulary were very similar in both groups. as was reading comprehension, interestingly, and we think it was related to the actual measure, so we've changed that for our next study. But I did look at it by age, and I found that with the younger children, closer to 8 to 12 years old, their reading comprehension was fairly comparable across both groups. But as they got older, the text types become more complex. That's where the groups started to differ. But when you clump them all together, they don't look that different. What we did find, however, at the group level, was that the oral discourse measure was significantly different between groups. And for the social communication behaviors, a higher score means more deficits. So, as you would expect, that was the result there, significant. So what was particularly interesting, though, was the difference in the relative strengths of the relationships between these factors in the two groups. So in the control group, vocabulary and oral discourse comprehension correlated moderately and were predictive, but not overwhelmingly so, of reading comprehension. And this is exactly what we'd expect based on reading comprehension in non-autism populations. The social communication measure did not correlate at all with reading comprehension in the control group, again, not surprising. What was interesting, however, is that all three measures correlated highly and were uniquely predictive of reading comprehension in students with autism. And you can see the correlations are quite different in the two language measures. So this is, we think, supports our hypothesis that syndrome-specific impairments in social communication development may be expressed in reading comprehension deficits in many students with autism. So this leads us to our current study. We are now doing a longitudinal assessment of reading development. This time we're following 80 students with autism and 80 without for over a three-year period. ASD diagnosis this time is being confirmed with the ADOS-2 as well as parent reports. And it's actually embedded in a larger longitudinal study of attention and academic achievement. We're also assessing math and writing. And this is an IES-funded study under Dr. Peter Mundy. And we're very excited about this study because it's the first of this scope to examine these factors in students with autism. This time around, we've changed our reading comprehension measure. We have a standardized measure called the Gray Oral Reading Test, and we also have a curriculum-based assessment of reading comprehension, the Qualitative Reading Inventory. While having a diagnosis of autism may affect reading comprehension, this certainly doesn't predict reading skills entirely. We need more detailed assessment of things such as decoding, word-level skills, sentence and oral discourse-level skills, fluency, working memory, as well as social communication behaviors. Several of our measures also specifically assess oral language abilities, since it's been shown that children with language deficits may have the most severe reading impairments. Our goal is to learn more about the factors that contribute to reading and overall academic achievement in students with autism so that we can supply better interventions and move forward.
Hi, I'm Julie Bradford. I am not a researcher. I'm a parent. How many parents are out here in the audience? Oh, good. Okay. I feel better already. I am going to talk a little bit about my exposure to some of the research here at the Mind, as well as my experience raising my daughter, Sarah, who is 24 years old. So, tell me, what is it you plan to do with your one wild and precious life? And as we think about transition, I think that, you know, transition for all of our kids on the spectrum is the same as anybody else. The question is, what are you going to do with your life? I mentioned that I'm the mother of Sarah. Sarah's 24. She lives with autism spectrum deficits, and she has a vision for her future, and she's working toward achieving an independent life for herself. Sarah gave me permission to talk about her tonight. I have a couple pictures of her. She's in the audience, so she's probably cringing. I want to speak to the parents for just a moment because I think that it's an opportunity for us to honor the people who are in the trenches working with our AS students. Before our children were born, I suspect that each of us had a vision for our unborn child. And we probably imagined a typical child growing up in a world full of opportunity. When we received a diagnosis for our child, suddenly the typical child we had envisioned no longer existed. We became the parent our child needed us to be. We became an advocate, a protector, a researcher, a counselor, and a case manager. We learned a new lifestyle, and we learned a new vocabulary. We learned about IEPs. We learned about insurance appeals, lots of appeals. We learned about therapies, labels like PDD, NOS. And we learned to manage medications. We probably had some guilt about not doing enough for our child, or we had guilt about doing too much for them. And now we're facing the transition years, the age from roughly 13 to adulthood. In our children's early years, we focused on evaluations and assessments because we needed those to get services. So we got labels and we identified weaknesses to make the case for why our kids should receive therapies, speech therapies, occupational therapies, social skills training, and so on. We may have slipped into a pattern of looking for fixes for our children. And when advocating for our children, it has been our role to explain their deficits to other people. But as our children age into the transition years, it's time to refocus our attention and our efforts. The days of us explaining deficits are coming to an end because we have to accept our kids for who they are. Our challenge is to see them as young adults who are capable of making decisions for themselves and support their efforts to become the most independent and productive individuals they can be. We need to ask them to define what they plan to do with their one wild and precious life. So I want to take a moment to congratulate all of the parents in the audience for the priceless support you've provided for your child. It's not an easy job, and it tends to be a very thankless job. So congratulations. Well done. I don't have research results to give you, but I have some advice based on my own experiences and experiences of many of the parents that I've talked with here at the Mind and the Resource Center. So the first thing I would tell a parent to do when confronting this transition issue is to get yourself a team. Surround yourself with professionals and service providers who can advise you and offer the most appropriate supports. Make sure they understand who your child is. Ask them to attend all the IEPs. Encourage your child to interact with them and explain what your child wants. Have them explain it directly to them. Ask a lot of questions. Don't accept all of the answers. Challenge those people on your team to be creative in meeting your child's needs. And then use your marketing and networking skills. You need these people. And if you can make friends with them, it helps. So tell them thank you. And if you've got someone on your team that's not working, everyone has the opportunity to switch and find somebody else that's going to get done what you need done for your kid. Get yourself a binder. It's a good idea always to have a current, accurate assessment before your child leaves high school. You're going to need that when you're applying to college programs. If they go to the disability services programs, they're going to need assessments to verify that they've got some kind of a deficit. You'll also need this information if you're applying for Social Security income for your child. If you are in the throes of transition issues for your kid, educate yourself. We have so many great programs happening here. Think College Conferences. ThinkCollege.net is a great website where you can find out about colleges that are available for anyone that's on the spectrum. And there are all kinds of collaborative meetings here, bringing together professionals from high schools and colleges. Patty mentioned we're having something tomorrow night. Parents aren't invited to that one, but hopefully we're going to get that information out to everyone afterwards. Success Defined is a great program here. It's a student-centered transition planning project, and the idea is that you get your team together, you listen to your child's vision of what they want their life to be. Also, the Mind Summer Institute is happening this year on August 2nd. So that's another great resource. So, strategies to achieve successful self-advocacy skills. We heard earlier, you guys were perfect, you set me up for this. We were hearing how some of the autism spectrum students don't graduate until six years later, because they are really lacking those self-advocacy skills. It is the most important skill we can teach our children. But there's a problem for us parents because we've been their advocates and protectors for so long, and it's hard for us to stand back and allow our children to make mistakes. Our challenge is to offer encouragement for all of their attempts to be independent. Even when we think it may be misdirected, I'm sure my daughter's in the audience shaking her head at this, but encourage the effort and allow them to make their own mistakes. Patty talks a lot in her presentations about how important the process is. It's not the product that you produce on the other end. It's how they get there. So if you can encourage them to use as much self-advocacy, self-determined skills as possible. And start early because the transition period can be a really tough time. Once your kids get to a college situation, their instructors and counselors are not required to talk with you. So suddenly we're out of the loop. And without a structured full-time school schedule, we might see our young adults doing a little couch surfing. And that can be terrifying. So the earlier that we can talk with them about self-advocacy skills and promote those types of behaviors in everything that they do, the better off we'll be. Another piece of advice is to accept what you have. At this point, when we get to those transition years and our kids are headed off to college, we need to accept their deficits and develop strategies to continue to support them. So I'm going to give you an example. In my case, my daughter has trouble initiating and taking responsibility for tasks. I just attended one of Patty Shetter's conferences last week, and I learned that one of the things that we can do is an effective behavioral strategy called the thinking tool for self-evaluation and goal setting. So it's a concrete visual tool, which is in my daughter's wheelhouse. She's a visual learner, and it can help her learn the relationship between her behavior and resulting outcomes. So it's interesting. If you think about the skills that are the most important to maintain a job, you need to be able to work independently, and you need to have the ability to initiate and complete tasks. So this is a very important life skill for her to have, and that's one of those tools that will apply to her specifically. So accept the deficits that your child has and find strategies to help compensate. Transition is not a program, it's the way we live. It's the way all of us live. It's not just confined to those folks that are on the spectrum. We need to define what success looks like for the individual across all of these life elements. The plan for each person will be entirely unique and different. As you've heard them say, if you've met one autistic person, you've met one autistic person. The goal is to strive for an integrated life and community inclusion. Self-determination is up there at the top. Without that, and without the individual feeling that they can create change in their own life and advocate for themselves, none of those other little bubbles are going to spin around that planning. So let's take a look at one of the bubbles, and that is the post-secondary education and vocational training. I'm not sure if very many people here are actually in the process of determining whether their child's going to go get a diploma or if they're going to have a certificate of completion. But that's really one of the first things that will determine how your college career or vocational or work life looks like. So I was thinking I could use Sarah again as an example. Sarah has a certificate of completion. And with that, she could start to work, get an internship or supported employment. She can go to a local educational area transition program, which she did. Sac City Unified School District has a transition program that's in a duplex next to Sac City College. So it's a great spot where the students can congregate. They get help around making a social plan for the week, deciding how much money they need, if they're going to go out with someone, who is that, how are they going to get there, what are they going to do, how much is it going to cost, you know, real life skills. And because this duplex is close to Sac City College, she also took community college classes. Another option for our students with a certificate of completion is to go to adult school and get a general education development diploma later, or to go to vocational programs. And then from community college, you have the options of getting an AA degree, transferring to a four-year college, or getting a vocational certificate. In Sarah's case, she spent a couple of years at Sac City College, and then she decided that she wanted to go away to school. So she went to Taft College to their Transition to Independent Living program, which is, if you haven't heard of it, there are several colleges in California which offer on-site residential programs for our intellectually disabled students. And they're allowed to live in their own homes with roommates. It's a working classroom. They figure out how to make a menu for the week, and they got to go shopping and cook and do their laundry. And in Sarah's case, she had several jobs while she was there, lots of opportunities to try different things out. She settled on childcare. She loved working with little kids, and she was able to take 6 units of early childhood education there, and she now has a California permit for a teaching assistant. And then the other route is more traditional with the high school diploma, military work, four-year college, or community college. Here's Sarah with her permit at graduation. Okay. Back to this for just a moment. I'm not going to go through each one of the bubbles, but these are all the components that you would need when you go through your transition plan. Who are going to be the social supports for you? Are you going to qualify for independent support services? If you're a regional center client, yes. Maybe you rely on private companies to do that for you. Community inclusion, things like, are you going to do volunteer work? Join a team, Special Olympics. Financial considerations, quickly, if you qualify for Social Security income, make sure that you apply when your child is 18. Take a look at special needs trusts. If your child has any money that you can put into a trust that they can then use according to the Social Security restrictions. Housing, I think, is one of the toughest things. There just is not a lot of housing out there. Safety training, that's always a concern. There's a couple of programs here in Sacramento. Dave Stincelli does a personal safety class, which has been great. Health medical care, you know that you can keep your child on your insurance until they're 26. After that, look at Medi-Cal. And you can apply for Medi-Cal when they're 18. And then job development and employment, which is a whole full-day conference all on its own. So I love this thing. Wealth is not about money. It's about having options. And it's the same for all of us, to be able to give your child a lot of opportunities to try things. Get as much experience as possible. Start early. Ask them what they're interested in. Get them different experiences so that they can make reasonable choices about what it is that they want to do. And in our case, it's Sarah. Here she is. This is the end result. She is very productive, working at a child care center, and this is a picture of her with her students.
As a mom of an autistic son, I would like to ask Amanda, when my husband and I are talking in front of him about stuff, does he understand everything? I mean, when your parents were talking about you and saying things like that, did you understand everything they were saying, and did you think it was just rude of them not to, you know, how that is? Because sometimes we just say, well, you know, he needs to do this or that, and like he's not in the room because he's not going to understand. But did you understand all the stuff that everybody was saying, or like if your parents were arguing, did you just tune it out? Or because I always just, sometimes you can ignore him with his autism, you can just ignore him. And so I just wondered what you knew. And thank you so much for your service and inspiration.
Oh, it's been hard at times. I've learned to tune out my parents when they sometimes raise their voices, but after a while, you just kind of get used to it. And I could understand. I knew how it was to communicate. It wasn't always easy.
When you were saying that you are selecting student bodies to do these research studies, what is the process for selecting the student body, and how do you qualify it, and how do you select those students?
So for the particular study we're doing right now, they're all UC Davis students, and several of the students who either have a diagnosis of autism, ADHD, or an anxiety disorder are recruited through the Student Disability Center. We also are posting flyers around campus as well that describes the specific eligibility criteria, and we're probably also going to go through the dorms, too, to identify students.
Is there a student body who's applying for college upcoming years? Is it something that you guys are sort of consider as a student body to get enrolled at UC Davis because of these sort of study cases at all? I mean, if they're capable of maintaining school, you know, work, right? I mean, how, you know, is there any potential for, I mean, this is a really interesting study. I mean, if I could have an opportunity for, you know, some of the students, you know, who's eligible to be able to apply through the UC system to be able to be the case study, I think it's really great. I mean, is there any opportunity?
Right. So the current study right now is just for students enrolled. However, the future study we're hoping will be funded would be an intervention study, and then we would be targeting incoming freshmen as well as students across, you know, the different levels, so freshmen, sophomore, junior, and senior. So if there were a student enrolling at that point, they would probably make it into the study.
I actually have a follow-up to that. I'm curious as to how many students were they able to actually get into UC Davis. I would think that that's extremely hard to do. And is there a disability center that helps accommodate them to get into a school like UC Davis?
Okay, so a few questions. I'll probably forget it, sorry. So I don't think we have a really clear understanding of the percentage. One reason is because several students won't disclose that they have a disability, and or they might not consider themselves to have a disability. So right now, as far as I understand, through the Student Disability Center, about 15 students with autism are being served. I don't think that at all represents the actual percentage of students on campus with autism, but I don't have a true sense for that, unfortunately.
Where are the resources? Perhaps you could point me in the right direction or address this. For parents of children that don't have the expressive skills to let you know what they would like to do with their lives, that are at a lower, not severe, sort of middle of the spectrum area, that maybe at, in my case, 17-year-old who academically is more on a first grade level, who does not have conversational skills, who can speak but doesn't have conversational skills and does not have the ability to tell me what he would like to do as he, or even has a concept of future.
So I would like to personally invite you to come to Success Defined with your is it a son?
A son.
Success Defined. It's an activity that we hold here at the Mind Institute, and it's really geared around youth development. And we've really been blessed with some amazing volunteers from the community as well as staff from our SED to be able to work with just a real diverse group of youth that come here through the use of things like visual supports and interviewing their care provider to get some basic information, but really working with them to be able to develop you know, some goals and some life plans and things like that. So the information about Success Defined typically is, you'll see it through Facebook if you're a friend on Facebook. So there's a little plug for that. But our website, the SED website, will have information about upcoming Success Defined events.
You are my grandson, Amanda. And I'm sorry, but I'm still trying to wrap. But I just want to know... You do everything that he does. You are him, and I just want to know how you make me so hopeful for him. That one thing they said he probably wouldn't talk, but he's very verbal, and I think it's because of his 11-year-old brother, and he's extremely verbal. But when you say you line everything up, he always wants to line everything up. And I'm just curious. Just tell me a little bit about how you. I don't know, if you sound like you had a lot of therapy or a lot of sessions with people, and I don't know how to get on that right now.
I've had to learn from my parents and the family and friends. We've had to borrow money from family, and we had to take out a second mortgage on our house. We were living in the dark ages. That's what my parents say.
You made a suggestion about inviting our teenagers to the IEP meetings. My question is, how productive would that be? Because even for us, the parents who are, quite frankly, well-educated, I'm a lawyer, but I still have difficulty understanding those IEP meetings and exactly what I'm achieving at an IEP meetings. And so... how in the world, when we invite our teenagers to those meetings, that can be productive?
Well, I think it depends on, I think that's a really good observation. And it sounds like a lot of parents feel that way as well. I think it depends. You should think about what your purpose is for inviting the student. If the purpose is for the student, I mean, some families don't use the words autism or disability around their students. And so you have to kind of weigh what your choices and your values are around that decision about inviting them to the IEP. Some of the advantages of having them there is learning some of those self-advocacy skills that are so important in going forward and helping them develop those year after year after year by saying, you know, I hate it when I have to sit in the front of class. That makes me stand out to my friends. I don't like it. And having them be able to say something like that in an IEP, that's the opportunity to say, okay, so you don't want to sit in the front of class. What else can we do then to kind of help you out? Maybe it would be better if you sat in the second row and you had a peer, you know, remind you, you know, help you out and kind of sit next to you and ask questions and make sure that, you know, answer any questions if you're having trouble listening to what the teacher's saying or doing something like that. So coming up with creative solutions, in response to what that student wants or needs, and giving him or her the right to be able to say, I'm sick and tired of being pulled out of class to go to speech therapy, you know, and coming up with another solution for that problem. I think it's really important as a speech therapist and as someone who sat in a lot of IEPs, it's really important for me to hear that from a student, to hear them say something like that. Because that way, I mean, my goal is to help them. My goal is to be their advocate. And so... opening up that line of communication, I think, is a really important reason to have them there. And it doesn't have to be for the whole IEP. It can be for the last 20 minutes where you've kind of already discussed everything, and then you bring the student in and say, you know, hey, this is what we were thinking about doing this year. What do you think about that? And give them the opportunity to say yay or nay, or asking them also, what do you want to do this year that's new? I was recently working with a student whose main goal in life right now is to have a girlfriend. That's all he wants to do, is to have a girlfriend. And so we've been working on that. And over the weekend, he went to the prom with a group of other students. And we were able to set that up with him. And it was a really great thing. And as we're working on social skills then with him, we can kind of, you know, invite that conversation. Like, you know, girls don't really like it when you pick your nose. They don't like that. So don't do that anymore. So opening up that line of communication promotes self-advocacy, and that's important.
The other thing that I wanted to add is I think that the dynamic of the IEP meeting changes. Mm-hmm. When the student is actually there and participating. And I think a lot of the process ends up shifting a little bit, and the student, particularly if they're taught how to lead the IEP, which is a great strategy, they run the agenda. I've actually worked with students where a typical IEP might take 2 hours when they're not there, takes 45 minutes when they're there, and actually gets more succinct and down to the point, and everyone's happy when that happens. So, but it does take preparation. The other thing that I wanted to say is, you know, student participation in the IEP, them being invited and them having at least some input into the IEP is actually a legal requirement from the time that they're 16 on. But it can be done in so many different ways. For example, preparing a PowerPoint presentation. Here are the things that I like. Here are the things that are hard. Here are the things that help. And just having the student, you know, participate by going over that PowerPoint. Having them present pictures of things that interest them, things that they like to do. And even if they're limited in their communication, they can still click the button that advances the slide and participate and start to have a voice in being able to share with that team what's relevant and important and helpful to them. So keep your eyes open. We may be having a workshop soon on student-led IEPs here through the SED. It's definitely something that I'm a huge advocate for. So,
I have a question. I'd like to know from all the parents in the audience and you up there, how many of you have autistic or Asperger children who are in their 20s or in their late teens who say, I don't have Asperger syndrome, you know, I am a normal person, and therefore it's very hard to help them? And is there any research into, like, what percentage of Asperger and autistic kids are like that?
Well, I don't know about percentage, but I do know that there are a lot of ways that you can advocate and for services or for help for a student without using a label like autism or Asperger's or anything. I mean, for example, this guy that I brought up earlier, you know, he doesn't necessarily say, I have autism, but he goes, I want a girlfriend, and I don't know how to talk to girls, so will you help me talk to girls? You know, that's something really specific. It's a social skill, and so that label isn't really important. It's about, what do you want us to help you with? What do you need? And then you can go off, okay, well, this person, they know about how to help you with what you need. So let's figure out how to do that, coming up with it in a creative way like that.
The UC Davis Mind Institute was created in 1998 with a promise to find cures for neurodevelopmental disorders. Every day, our physicians and researchers come closer to fulfilling that promise. Their groundbreaking research on autism, Fragile X syndrome, chromosome 22q11.2 deletion syndrome, ADHD, and other brain disorders are helping children achieve their fullest potential. Please visit our website to find out more about current studies, upcoming events, and how you can help make a difference.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.